that sometimes how we say something is just as important as what we're trying to get across. So the whole idea, again, is moving somebody one step closer to our, to Christ. If that's our goal, we should choose our words carefully, and we should think about how what we're saying comes across. Because it has a purpose, and it's an important purpose. So you can have all the truth in the world, but you can fail to make it compelling because you're just being careless about your needs. We should never think that just because we're fortunate enough to be adopted into the body and as God's children, that we can just sort of throw it out there without thinking about what we're doing. Okay, so let me pray and then we'll dive into it. God, thank you for tonight. Thank you for everything you're doing in our lives. Thank you for the truth, and help us to individually and as a body of Christ all over the world deliver your truth in this difficult age we live in. Your truth is compelling, Lord, if we share it in a meaningful way and depend on your spirit. Thank you for that, and please guide our thoughts tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, so I have a couple more tactics tonight to share, and I'll be fairly brief on these, unless questions come up, and then we'll spend the rest of the time doing more practical, situational practices of thinking through some situations, maybe practicing them. Okay, so our next tactic is called Rhodes Scholar. And we said this a little bit last time, but I looked it up just to have a phrase to tell you. The Rhodes Scholarship, established in 1902, it's named for the British mining magnate and South African politician Cecil John Rhodes. And it's an international postgraduate award for non-British students to study at the University of Oxford. And the award is widely considered to be one of the world's most prestigious scholarships. So here's a few names of people who have received it. Bill Clinton, 1968. Some people may know who George Stephanopoulos is. He has like a name show.
He was on the Clinton cabinet, and now he's an anchor.
Yeah, you know, actually what's funny is that as I looked through the list of people who have had the Rhodes Scholarship, there are a lot of connections to Bill Clinton. So I don't know what that means. Wait, what's going on here? Bill Bradley, he's been in politics as well.
Mayor Bradley, maybe.
Chris Christopherson, the and there's, you know, there are, if you read through the list, there are quite a few people who have been in government. They can be senators, mayors, representatives, presidents. So the idea being is it's prestigious, right? So you look up to these people as being well educated and advanced in their knowledge. You could probably call this, I thought maybe even a better name for the tactic would be the rocket scientist tactic, right? Oh, if you're a rocket scientist, you just really know a lot, and your education is so much higher than mine. And that's sort of the go-to example of somebody when you are schooling and understanding. So the idea is that the highly educated have a certain level of authority that others don't. So that's true in a sense, right? I mean, there are certain things that you can only know if you're advanced in a certain field. So there is a sense in which their authority gives them, their education gives them certain authority that others might not have. But you can think of other contexts where an appeal to an authority figure like that would not be justified. So, for instance, just in general terms, let's say you have a philosopher making a statement about science. Not about philosophy of science, but a philosopher talking about some scientific theory itself or something like that. There's a chance that you have to step back and say, wait a second, that's not your field. And vice versa, right? If a scientist says something about philosophy, the same field. There's a sense in which there's a higher level of scrutiny when you're outside your your proper authority. And even regardless of that, there's another element you could say, and that's that regardless of who it is or what field they've studied in, you still have to judge the concept on its, or the view on its own merits.
Right.
It still has to be given a good argument with the proper evidence or reasoning behind it, even if they do have the appropriate authority. So that's yet another element. So here's some, I sort of written these out as questions we can ask when we're dealing with an appeal to authority. Somebody has a view and they say so-and-so says such and such. What are we supposed to do with that? Are we supposed to accept it or not? So here's some things to think about. One is if they're in field. So we mentioned that, you know, if you're outside your field, then you're no longer necessarily the appropriate authority for that statement. Number two, are they in a unique position to know the facts or make a judgment? So sometimes, you know, I think we have to depend on authority because it's something we just can't ever be in a position to make a definitive statement about. Okay. Even if they are in a special place to make a statement, what are the reasons, and are they sound and compelling? So you can have all the letters behind your name you want, but if I look at your argument and there's a simple logical fallacy in that, any of the things we've talked about, if it's self-refuting or something like that, it doesn't matter how many degrees you have.
And lastly, and sometimes most importantly, is there an underlying philosophical bias?
So say you make a definitive statement. This seems to happen a lot in discussions of science these days. A scientist in his field, he's talking about scientific data, but has certain presuppositions that are worldview presuppositions, like naturalism, for instance, that there is nothing beyond the natural. So any interpretation of his data that he's going to give is going to be based on, well, it's got to be within the wheelhouse of naturalism. I can't go beyond that. And that's going to affect what his statements are from authority. So even though he's an insider in the field, it's all colored by his philosophy. For instance, the book The Grand Design by, how can I draw that? The genius scientist who's in a wheelchair.
Oh, it's Stephen Hawking.
Stephen Hawking and Mladenov, I believe, wrote it. The first introduction portion of the book talks about how science has supplanted philosophy. There's no longer a need for philosophers because they're not getting the job done. What's getting the job done is scientists who are crunching hard data and having these advances. And then he proceeds to argue for a long time using philosophy. So he's denouncing philosophy and he's using it, and he's using it from outside of the discipline of being a philosopher. He's actually a scientist. And he hasn't done any, you know, deep courses in philosophical thought. So we have to know where they're coming from, whether it's the field or their presuppositions.
Sometimes when we're interacting or we're noticing something and we're seeing that problem, sometimes we call it fallacy of expert witness.
So this is the idea of the witness on the stand, and it's like taken for granted that whatever they say is admissible as evidence. Simply by their authority. So you don't have any back and forth, you don't have any discussion of the merits of their research or their schooling or their biases. It's just, you're the witness, therefore what you say is admissible evidence. So when we're talking about reasoning and dealing with people's ideas and interacting, that's what we call that fallacy of expert witness, when somebody just sort of punts to an expert and says,
I'm old enough to have watched reruns of the show Dragnet.
Dragnet.
In syndication. I'm not, but I'm young enough to not have seen it when it was live, or when it first came out. So, but I can remember Joe Friday, the detective here. They're always tracking down witnesses and people who have something to give details on the case, and they're always saying, regardless of what people are saying, going this way and that way, or questioning whether or not they should be there, they're always saying, we're just trying to get the facts. That's all we want. We're just trying to establish the facts of the case. So that's where the name of this comes from.
Who's the character?
Joe Friday. Yeah. Jack Webb is the actor.
Who's the actor?
Jack Webb. Yeah, TVs. What's funny is that this is one of those things where everybody knows this sort of stock phrase, just the facts, man, and they think that's the catchphrase of the show. But if you go watch, like if you were to watch every episode, you would hardly ever hear it. You might hear a variation of it, but it's one of those things that's like urban legend almost, where everybody thinks that that's what they said, but if you actually go back and look at it, which is kind of funny, because it's all just the facts, man. And that's attributed to him, but that's not really a good fact.
Oh,
it's kind of ironic.
Okay. Yeah.
But the idea is that we want to get the correct information. That's why it's a good image, right? A detective, and he's just trying to get the right information. So there are essentially two steps here, and I know they seem kind of obvious, but they're important. Number one, what is the claim? So you're dealing with somebody, you're having a discussion or interaction, or they say something, and you want to know what the claim is. And that's simple enough, but sometimes it isn't that simple because somebody can say something and mean another thing, or they can say one thing but actually have two ideas running side by side on what they said. A sort of comical example of that is I know enough, but let's see how many years have I been married. It'll be 16 years this August. And I know from experience and from any, you know, marriage seminars I've been to or anything like that, that there's a difference between what is said and the injunction. They call it the injunction of what is said. The injunction is what is actually meant or what is implied by what you said, which could be additional information or it could be instead of what was actually said. So the classic is, something like, I'm going to go do this, and then the answer is, go ahead, I'll be fine. Which doesn't mean that at all. It actually means, how did I write it under? It means, it's definitely not okay, but it's a free country, so continue with your plans at your own risk. Something like that.
It's like what women say versus what they really mean.
Something like that, yeah. I can be guilty of the same thing, so it's not necessarily a gender thing, but for some reason it's classically the guy trying to do something when he's not being sensitive to the needs that are happening at home, and he asks, and then he's oblivious to the injunction, because they, So we ask, we'll find out what the claim is, and then simply, is it accurate or not? Does it comport with the facts. Here are some pointers we can go through. Be alert for bad information. So, for instance, there are some people who are charismatic and you can come up with some different adjectives. They're charismatic or they're forceful or they're well-spoken or they're endearing. And even though they're saying something that isn't right, you're just sort of convinced by the delivery of it. So we should always be on the alert because things can just slide right past us And if they're taken for granted in our discussion, then we've lost that little tidbit that's really important. That could be the determinant factor of why what they're saying doesn't make any sense. We need to know that. So we can't know everything, but if we pay attention and we try to be well-read when these things come up, if we already know, then we can just point out the inaccuracies. And, you know, certain things come up over and over again. Well, they'll come up later in some examples, so I won't give away, but... but just take a little bit of commitment, right? I mean, it's one thing to sort of stay up on current events and read about these different issues. That's pretty casual and easy, and that gives you some information. But to really know the facts, sometimes you have to stop and go, wait a second, I have a mission here that when I engage people, I want to have something to say. So this article was really well stated, and it has some good statistics in it. I'm going to take a minute, write them down, review them, get a couple of these memorized. You know, so the next time somebody tells me something about you know how many people were killed in the Crusades, I can say, well, actually, that's not quite right. Or have you ever researched that? Because you know the fact, so you can call them out. And lastly, precise numbers are more compelling than general figures. So, let's see, where's the... He has a statistic in here. So, for instance, saying thousands died in the terrorist attacks of 9/11. That's one way of saying it, right? But what if you say 2,973 human beings were buried beneath the rubble of the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the field in Pennsylvania on September 11th, 2001. So that's a lot more precise, right? So it conveys a couple things. One, that you've carefully thought about it and studied it, and it's the exact information. So you're sort of making an authoritative factual statement rather than just a vague, like, I think, you know, generally this. Here, let me share one more story from the book. It's one of my favorite stories in this book. And it shows the exact situation where this came into play. Let's see. Okay, this is great go boy. I was once involved in a head-to-head encounter of sorts with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Gary Willis before San Francisco's Little Commonwealth Club, which was staged for national broadcast on NPR. In his opening salvo on the topic, Christianity in America, Professor Wills disputed the idea that the founding fathers of our republic were Christians. They were not Christians, he claimed, but deists. The microphone was then passed to me. By the way, have you heard this? I mean, I hear that often.
Or like a, let's see, James Hamilton, Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, Thomas Paine, and one other one that proposed the separation of church and state and deliberately said that this country is not a Christian country.
Right, so pointing to things, this is an instance of pointing to things to try to dissolve this notion of a Christian nation or a Christian founded nation.
Exactly. I just saw something recently on that.
So he says, they were not Christians, he claimed, but he is. The microphone was then passed to me. Fortunately, I have my facts. Quote, the phrase founding fathers is a proper noun, end quote, I explained. Quote, it refers to a specific group, the delegates to the Constitutional Convention. There were other important players not in attendance, but these 55 made up the core, end quote. I then continued citing from memory the best I could, the following facts that were a matter of public record. Among the delegates were 28 Episcopalians, 8 Presbyterians, 7 Congregationalists, 2 Lutherans, 2 Dutch Reformed, 2 Methodists, 2 Roman Catholics, 1 unknown, and only three deists, Williamson, Wilson, and Franklin.
Oh, deists or atheists?
Deists.
Oh, deists, okay.
This took place at a time when church membership usually entailed, quote, sworn adherence to strict doctrinal creeds, end quote. This tally proves that 51 of 55, a full 93% of the members of the Constitutional Convention, the most influential group of men shaping the political independence of our nation, were Christians, not atheists. When I was finished, I set my microphone down and waited, bracing for the rebuttal from my learned opponent. But he said nothing. After a few moments of awkward silence, the moderator moved on to a new topic. Dr. Wills had his facts wrong. Mine were not only correct, but they were precise, had a tremendous persuasive power to my rebuttal. So that's a great illustration. I mean, not only having the facts, but having it in such a way that it basically ended the objection that the person had.
Yeah, because there were four people that say it was not a Christian-based nation. However, look at the entire, 56 delegates?
51 of 55. Now, I'm not saying there isn't further discussion there, but he laid the facts on the table. He didn't spin them. He just said, this many guys were congregational, so this many guys, you know, that's a matter of public record, like you said.
Yeah, okay.
So when you throw that out there, that's this new starting point for everything. It's no longer the allegation that the person had. Okay, so that's the last tactic for tonight. And the rest of the time, I would just like to deal with some potential real-life scenarios. They're potential because these aren't like something that I've actually had, but they're realistic enough that they could happen. And before we get into that, just to clarify something, our prime concern is how to engage. We said that. That's more of our focus than getting knee-deep in philosophy or abstract ideas or understanding every tidbit of every argument at this point. That's a lifetime project. I mean, I've been studying this stuff for a while and I still feel like it's the tip of the iceberg for me. So, but with what I do know, I don't have a way of engaging that's useful, and I'll continue to learn that. On the other hand, it's a method that sort of writes, that sort of depends on content, right? I mean, at some point, I mean, even if you went out cold, right, and you use this method, you could have a few engagements, go back and do a little bit of study on the questions that people ask, or that you ask people, and you came up on their views, and you said, well, I don't know about that, so I better go read up on that, which is fine, right? But at some point, after you did that a few times, you would have that knowledge. So there's sort of back and forth between this method and knowledge here, and so I'll try to keep the philosophy flow to a minimum so as not to obscure the method, but at the same time, it's just par for the course a little bit, so we'll do our best to balance that. And you know, now that I think about it, honestly, most of the people that you're going to interact with, potentially, I mean, even for me doing campus ministry, there are certain people, you know, say professors, that are going to be a harder engagement for me. But just the normal student or the normal Orange County person, if you do a little bit in your memorizing a few facts, studying a few arguments, and knowing them basically, you are already several steps beyond the normal person. So it doesn't take too much content to get beyond just the average American. So here's what I want to do. I want to present this first one. Or actually, well, let me give a sort of a overview of what we're doing with these, what I call real situations. Here are some things that we're trying to ask. Using what we've discussed, how would you start a conversation? Again, this is based on the stories we'll come up with here. Based on the response, what rock do you want to leave on your shoe? So in other words, you're anticipating, it looks like we're going to talk about this general issue, so I'm going to pick this one piece of information and try to get them to think about this when I leave them. Are there shared questions you can ask that will draw out their view further and get them to reassess their view? So that would fall under, when we talk about convo leading questions, these would be questions where you're trying to draw them out to understand what they're saying better and show why maybe they need to rethink that, rather than thinking about it further. And last, what tactics apply? Where is the faulty reasoning? So depending on what they're saying and how they're saying it, then you know we have a buffet of ideas that we've gone through. Where we can be observant. Do they have the facts wrong? Right? Is what they're saying self-refuting? Things like that. So I'm going to put up this first one, and I'll read it, and then I'll pause for a moment and go get a drink of water and come back in a couple minutes. We can break for that long and then come back and talk about this one, but I'll read it first. So here's a potential real-life situation. Your coworker, who you regularly eat lunch with, shared a quote from a newspaper article on Facebook last night. Pro-lifers have no right to oppose abortions unless they are willing to care for the children of mothers born in crisis pregnancies. You're about to meet for lunch, and social media is often the subject of your conversation. So I'm trying to portray, you know, there's some content there that's fodder for discussion, but I mean, this is not something that would, I mean, this is a pretty mundane example, right? I mean, it's work, it's the person you talk to regularly. It's a quote that was posted in a way that it's something you guys talk about all the time anyways. So you have it on your page there so you can cross-reference, but the idea is thinking through some of these questions, how does that work out in this situation? So our first thing is how do you even start the conversation when you're going to pause for a moment and connect. Okay. So we have a situation, and one thing we don't have is the person here to respond, so you sort of have to imagine what would happen, but so because of that, there's sort of two starting points. One, you know, the basic combo first question is what do you mean by that? That might something along that lines. But we also are probably asking ourselves at the same time, especially since this is just written and the person isn't here. We're probably asking what is the claim? We're trying to boil down what the issue is. So let's start with that for a moment. I mean, we can sort of walk through it, and we can even role-play it, but what all do you see happening here in this state? Let's put it that way. I guess what I'm saying is there more to their statement than kind of like we talked about? Is it just as simple as what it looks like, or is there more to it? Pro-lifers have no right to oppose abortions unless they're willing to care for the children of mothers born in crisis pregnancies. What do you think about that?
Well, it's a quote from a newspaper article, for one thing. So it's more or less an opinion rather than something based on fact. Yeah. It's somebody's opinion or their value on, and it does have a point because if you're pro-life, you're pro the life that's a argument there. However, it's based on an opinion or an observation rather than a set of facts. Either you're pro-life or you're not pro-life, and if you are pro-life, it should extend to this is the opinion. So that's a tough one. I don't really know how to.
Well, which parts of it are about values and which parts are about facts? Let's parse that out at least. That might be a clue. So I mean, if you take the whole statement, pro-lifers have no right to oppose abortions. .. That's not something empirical, right?
Right.
I mean, you can't. That's a matter of argumentation rather than evidence.
Yeah. That's correct. Yes.
But what about the latter half? Let's put it this way: in order for what they're saying to make sense, pro-lifers have no right to oppose abortions unless they're willing to care for the children of others born in crisis pregnancies.
If there were a bunch of people adopting unwanted crisis babies, would this statement even be stated?
It wouldn't have a lot of merit.
Yeah.
If there are more people that want to adopt than children available,
right,
and which seems to, for some strange reason, be the case, other than the people wanting to adopt are very picky about the type of child they're willing to take, and the genealogy, the race and the conditions under which that child was born.
Okay. Yeah,
that's right. But then again, if we flash back to the beginning, when we're talking about rights, there's an ethical statement there, right? They're saying what the proper ethics is. They're making an ethical statement that
they're taking a stand on an ethical issue that's more what's the word for it?
Well, they are. Saying there's an obligation.
They're putting a condition on somebody's position. They're putting a condition on
them. Yeah, that's
what
you're saying. Yeah. All right, so even what we just discussed, there are two separate things happening, right? There's an ethical issue, which is a matter of ethics, which isn't something where you go look at a statistics book. But then there is this underwriting idea that that there are not a bunch of people caring for mothers or unwanted babies, basically, or availing themselves to do that.
So those are two things we have to respond to, okay?
So
you noticed right away that there was some factual element to this, right? So how would you go about, if you didn't already have the facts, how would you go about answering this implicit charge that the pro-life movement isn't taking care of babies from mothers in crisis pregnancies?
Well, being willing to care for a child born in a crisis situation doesn't necessarily imply that you can't be pro-life unless you're willing to care.
I think that's accurate, and I think we can hash that out. I think that's the ethical side, but that's the argumentation side.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is, regardless of that, I mean, you could sort of grant that even for the sake of argument, and say, well, let's just talk about the facts. You sort of have this. You're applying this fact that pro-life people don't do something about crisis pregnancies. So, I mean, basically, we'll just look at that. Are they or are they not? Right?
Okay.
No. So, if you look it up, I mean, this would be a case where, and I didn't know the numbers until I looked at it.
for that. Yeah.
But if you had already looked at,
and this would be true as of when this book was written, so it's only, this information is only a few years old, but we could look it up again today. But as of when this was written, there were more than 4,000 pro-life clinics where if you're willing to have your baby, they'll help you with housing, food, shelter, you know, all the different things that you're going to go through in your crisis pregnancy, they're there to help you with, as long as you come in and avail yourself. So there's a number of just simple facts you could look at to deflate that half of the, that's one of the implied assertion here.
They're willing to place the child into a family. There's a family.
Yeah, you brought up adoption. That's a great point. I mean, even aside from the care clinics, hasn't there always classically been more people waiting for kids than there are?
What they say, that they don't want the children from, the inner city child that parents were on crack cocaine. Because a lot of times that child has problems and disabilities and mental problems that the adoption can turn into a nightmare.
Correct.
So then, but then they want to, there's a lot of privately funded clinics. There are many clinics that are privately funded by generous donors that do care for all of the medical and take care of all the arrangements to place the child and the family.
So it gets a little money there, but we observed a couple of statistical points there.
Right.
And, you know, what we can show is that based on how it's set here, we can say, no, there are an abundance of care clinics that will help people through these crisis pregnancies.
Yes, the pro-lifers are just people that claim to have a position. There's a lot of evidence to support the fact that pro-lifers go the extra mile with trying to carry out the care involved in this type of thing.
And so we sort of slipped into just the facts down here because we're noting that, and we're even giving specifics like 4,000, more than 4,000.
It's almost like what you call a hasty generalization that so many pro-lifers aren't willing to care for the children of crisis pregnancy or unwanted pregnancy, because there's plenty that do. So you can't make up.
So if we did all that, that was almost all for the sake of argument. I mean, we're sort of granting the ethical one at that point, because there's almost, there's always a question of, as the church that's supposed to love, how are we acting out that love? Okay, granted, that's always going to be a question that we need to do better at, probably. I mean, maybe we need to adopt more troubled children. That's fine. More troubled children. More difficult cases. Fine, you know, we can accept that, and that's okay, because we're not perfect. We want to be better at that and be a light. But anyways, that's not really central to the issue here. Even with all that, we're still got to go back to the ethical issue and say, well, does that even hold water? Is that right to say that your right to be pro-life is based on this obligation for you to care for the unwanted children?
See, that's the thing. Does that obligate you?
So, well, does it?
Morally, it can give you a conscionable debate. Morally, it can challenge your. It's morally challenging if you want to extend it to that.
Right. Well, there's. It raises questions about your own actions, yes. Because we want to be compassionate, yes. But just following the logic of it, we sort of used just the facts now on the other point. I think on this we can basically do a reductio by analogy. So basically we look at the logic of that and say, the idea was, what if that logic worked in different situations other than what we're saying? What if we put that logic on domestic violence? What if we said, if you're going to tell me that it's wrong to beat my wife, you have to be willing to marry her when we get divorced.
Oh.
That's the same logic, isn't it? That's essentially the same statement. So in order for you to have moral opposition to what is being done, you have to have an obligation to remedy the situation in a way above and beyond just your normal moral duties. I mean, that's what's happening here. So
what he's doing is rationalizing the fact that it's okay for him to treat his wife this way, and just like a...
Isn't that scary? I mean, that if they see that the logic is the same in those two statements, they obviously don't want that.
I can't see the comparative to this.
Okay.
In other words, they have no right to oppose.
Right. So if I'm going to come to you and say, you're beating your wife and you need to not do that, that would be the pro-life.
You have no right to oppose me telling you that you're wrong.
Well, yeah, if the pro-lifer is analogous to the person giving an objection to the person beating their wife, and the person beating their wife will be coming back and saying, you don't have any right to oppose unless you're willing to carry this further obligation. In this case, it's the further obligation is to care for the children. In that case, the obligation is to marry the wife, to care for the wife in a way that's beyond your normal moral duties. I mean, you may still have an obligation in some form or fashion to do the best you can, but do you have an obligation to marry the person? Do you have an obligation to adopt or take care of the person simply because somebody else dropped their moral obligation? I mean, it's sort of assuming the conclusion before you start that that if I bring something to the world, then somebody else has to take care of it. The obligation still lies with you. It's still an open question in debate whether abortion is right or wrong in the conversation. So for them, they're already concluding that they're adding that extra obligation on top of the argument.
But then the person that's hurting the wife, you have an obligation, a conscionable obligation to never ever harm or touch a woman, no matter what degree of anger you have.
Right. And the person intervening has an obligation to stop the violence, but they don't have an obligation to marry the person.
Exactly.
In the same way, we have an obligation to stop the murder, but we don't have an obligation necessarily to parent.
Okay,
the resulting child.
So you could have a moral position, a philosophical or moral or value, without having to further it by righting every wrong there is that's implied.
Something like that, yeah. I think so. If the world worked this way, the fundamental issue is, what I did with there was reductio ad absurdum by analogy. But that's just to illustrate the point forcefully to the person. I mean, the underlying question is it right or wrong? And that has nothing to do with what you're going to do after the fact.
Oh, yeah, your actions.
I'm just using that reductio as a really stark, pushback. But at that base, your ethical obligations are what they are, regardless of what somebody else decides. What if you decide to create a bad situation, that doesn't suddenly oblige me to solve the bad situation. Something like that. I found that out.
Okay, well, we'll let that one be. And now I've got a couple more, but I am open to if there's a particular situation you think is an actual real situation that you come up with, or want to talk about that sometime too.
Well, this isn't a real conundrum necessarily, but if I have a gentleman I know, and he had cancer and he recovered from it, but he hasn't been feeling well. So I think he's still in remission, but it just sort of put that urgency in me to think, man, you never know what's going to happen. Sometimes people have cancer, it goes through remission, and suddenly they get it again, and it's like immediate. So I've just really been putting the bug at me to talk to this person, because I've never had a real spiritual or worldview conversation with this person. It's mostly been work related. So that's an instance of somebody, when I made the challenge at the beginning, you know, take a risk somewhere at some time. That's the kind of person I have in my sights. To at least start a conversation, talk about one aspect of something at least, and maybe more. That's an example for me. But it's not, I don't have, well, let's see, what would be the situation? The situation would be I would show up to his office to talk to him about a potential project. And you gotta find an excuse to go there. it's not that hard, really. I mean, some of the examples I use are like, oh, they have a t-shirt or tattoo or something really distinct with the slogan. But sometimes you just start shooting the breeze and three paragraphs in, suddenly that comes up.
Yeah, it comes up naturally, but you don't want to lose the opportunity when it kind of falls in your lap, so to speak.
Yeah.
Or you might say, ask guidance with being sensitive to it so that you can always. When you don't miss out on the right opportunity, the door's open, the window's open. So don't, it's an obvious open,
right.
Rather than trying to, I don't want to offend them today, or find an excuse.
So don't hold back when the time is right.
That's it.
Yeah.
Because it may not come again.
That's right.
It may not come so easily again.
All right, well, I'll move to another one, unless you have any real life situations you want to add it to.
The thing about science is, that was a good one.
This one? Okay, let's do this one. Real situations, science, I call it science, whatever that bookstore. As the attendant hands you your receipt at the local bookstore, his t-shirt catches your attention. It says, "The good thing about science is that it's true whether or not you believe in it." And that's a quote from Neil deGrasse Tyson. So,
I'd say it's not foolproof. Science is not foolproof because it can readjust itself or reiterate its position at a future time where it's going to have to disqualify the stand it once took, that postulated as true based on fact and conclusion that no longer fits anymore.
I think that's
a good example. Can you think of an example?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, there's some real classic ones like the Earth versus the Sun being centered.
Oh, the Earth,
the Ptolemaic versus the, the See, this is why I need to know the facts.
Okay.
But, well, I think what you're onto there is the direction you can take this, right? That's perfect. You've got a direction. That's exactly the rock you can leave, but what you're trying to do is not just, like, blow out of the water, right? Unless it's that right opportunity. You know, sometimes it is that right opportunity, that's fine. I'm not saying don't ever just say something. But, I mean, this is the guy at the bookstore, and you may be meeting him for the first time. So, so you're sort of reverse engineering. From what you just, that immediately occurred to you, right? But the idea is to hold it attention enough, hold attention enough in yourself, and say, okay, I'm going to, like, sort of on the fly, you're thinking, from the first question onward, how am I going to sort of make a trail of breadcrumbs to get to this point so that I'm leaving them with this idea graciously?
So, and there's also the fact that you were already reacting to a certain understanding of the statement. So going back to that first step, what do you mean by that? In this case, you'd say what? You'd say, what's that shirt all about? Or, do you like Neil deGrasse Tyson? Something to get the conversation started. And give them an opportunity to exhibit whether they're, you know, number one Neil deGrasse Tyson fanboy, or if they just like the shirt. You know, they could be anywhere between those points. So you may have already gone farther. You remember I said, You may have already thought about some of these things 10 times more than somebody that actually has a t-shirt, you know. So we need to start with, what do you mean by that, or some variation of that? So, well, you want to run with this one? I'll be the t-shirt guy. Because you already have an idea of where you're headed. And you need interaction in order to play this out, because it's a little more of a big quote, right? I mean, it's not as distinct as the last one. Okay, so you're probably buying Tactics by Greg Kobel at the bookstore. And it's 14 minutes. Will that be cash or credit? Alright, so you bought the book, I give you your receipt. Now we're rolling. Thing. You're the customer.
I'm the customer, okay. So I buy the book.
Yes. Your shirt has this quote on it.
Oh, your shirt has a quote on it.
Yes.
Oh. Have you ever looked at this book that it's been a bestseller at your bookstore? Have you ever read anything in it?
Oh, this one?
Yes.
No. I've seen a few people buy it though. Is it good?
Well, I buy it because it was recommended to me, but I'm just curious as to whether you've looked at it. Do you believe what your shirt says? Do you really believe what your shirt says, that it's like an absolute truth, or do you see where your shirt may be faulty in what it's saying?
Okay, so curve yourself back to the beginning of the question. You see, you spilled all the beans all at once. Because if you just asked me without, you added in sort of the, you added in, right from the very get-go, you added in why I might be wrong.
Oh, okay.
So you just want to get me started.
Okay, I want to ask you, that's interesting what your shirt says. I never saw that quote before. That really makes, that's food for thought. What do you think about that? Since you're wearing the shirt, what attracts you to that quotation?
Yeah, I love the shirt. Well, it's gray. It's a gray shirt, so I like gray. But I like the quote because I don't know. Just, you know, people believe all sorts of crazy things, but science is really the only thing that is solid. Like, it never fails. So I like the idea of something that I like all my things that I probably wouldn't say that much. I'd probably just say what it's I think science is cool because it
it doesn't fail, it makes sense.
So you think something can be held true, but it doesn't depend on whether you believe it's true. It's either you hold the position that something is true just because it's true, regardless of whether you. So what do you believe is true? What can you think of that you?
Scientific things. I mean, like, Earth revolves around the sun, and I don't know, scientists know all sorts of things now about quantum physics. They keep figuring out how the world's made. Those things are true. So remember, you're trying to get me to leave with the idea of. You were going along the lines of science. At any point in history, you say, "Oh, science is true." And you go 100 years in the future, everything that you were dogmatically saying was true is no longer true.
But science, I mean, states that it's true, but with further research on any one thing, science right. has been known to refute itself. To recant its position on based on further understanding of any one given thing carrots are good for your eyes or the fact that the latest sure. it's considered to be a myth that carrots are good for your eyes.
So at some point you have that notion, you just got to put it in question.
Okay.
So, I mean, it can be as early as the third question or the second question if things go in the right direction. But, so what you want me to do is calculate that out within my own system.
Okay.
So you've already got me to sort of give you a general idea of what I'm thinking. And then you want to put that walk in my shoe. And then, you know, it's maybe a short conversation, but if there's a line or you don't want to tie them up while they're working.
Yeah.
So it might be you might have given a little affirmation, like, well, yeah, science does some really cool stuff. I mean, there's crazy technologies that we come up with because of science and all that. It's cool. But what do you do with, what do you do with examples of science that changes over time? Like, they thought one thing and now it's different. I mean, if it's always right, like you say, then what do you do with, how do you explain that? Something like that. Maybe that's even more strong. But then, see, it's in question form, so you're saying, well, I'm entertaining what you have to say, but I'm just not able to get over this obstacle. And then they're internalizing that obstacle rather than being challenged, like you just said. No, what I believe is right, and here's why I'm wrong.
Yeah, it's not a right wrong thing. It's getting them to think of what they're wearing that they consider to be pretty solid may not be so after all.
From what within what they're claiming or presenting to the world, you're exhibiting. A question from an observer was, you know, it's interesting, but what do you do with this? You're leaving something where.
Or you could say, I wasn't a believer in love until it happened to me. See what I mean? Or I didn't believe that it could happen, but then now I find something is true for me that before I didn't conceive of as being. I don't know. See, this is the problem coming down with. But I see what I need to work on as far as.
You see the logic of the method.
Right, the method.
It's just a matter of.
Comprehend it, but you give them reason to think, and then you can carry that further into what your goal is to get them to find reason to believe. Reason to believe that God could be real. It's based on the same reasoning. That the reasoning that God could be real is just as strong as an absolute that they're saying of something not existing.
Now, one way I could express this, anytime we come up against science, what we would call scientism, where it's just this sort of like, I'm all in with science and that's it. Like, that's the whole ballgame. One guy said it this way in a debate. He said, how do you deal with the fact that science is omnipotent? Like, he called it omnipotent. Like, I think the general idea in any of these kind of interactions is to do exactly what you're thinking. But in more general terms, the idea is, I need to leave some rock in her shoe that challenges the idea that science is everything. I mean, there are plenty of things. We dealt with this a little earlier, that the presuppositions of science are non-scientific. You can't... there's some, you know, more advanced stuff, like the speed of light being constant in one direction.
The speed of light being constant.
And in one direction. That has to be assumed before the theory is explained. Like, you can't get that from any empirical evidence. Well, I think we're headed very well in the right direction on that one. It's just a matter of...
Or they say nothing can exceed the speed of light when it was shown with, what's that thing called? It's in Bern, Switzerland, that...
The particle accelerator?
The particle hydrator? What was that thing called?
It's the one where they collide
particles. Yeah, they're trying to smash the atom to get to the God particle, and they've found something about neutrinos that may indicate that there's something that can exceed the speed of light.
Well, here's an interesting thing. I mean, just as another tiny rabbit trail to go on, but this is from an atheist. I think I was reading this in Lawrence Krauss, if I remember correctly, but he was noting how, and I found this interesting from an atheist, I don't know the context, but he was saying, we're in a position right now in the history of mankind where we can study and observe the universe. We're in, I can't remember the amount of time. It was more than a billion, maybe a couple billion years. Things will be moving away from us faster than the speed of light, and they will no longer be observable. So broadly speaking, within, you know, millions and millions of years, we're in a position where we can study the universe in a way that we wouldn't be able to later, because the expansion of the universe is continuing to accelerate. So at some point, we won't even be able to observe. I mean, if you're around it.
If it continues at the same momentum that it's doing,
right.
what we discovered it's doing now wasn't known maybe 50 years ago.
Yeah.
It wasn't known, but again, it's still theory that we perceive that, but maybe something else entirely is going on. I don't necessarily believe the Big Bang is true. I don't necessarily think that the universe is.
But here's the deal. One thing you and I can do at any moment, based on this little role play we did, food for thought, food for homework, is go and look up a few things. You know, I mean, just go find some raw data that helps illustrate your point. You can make the point you said by saying, citing historical examples. Or, only 25 years ago, this was the theory, and it was held by everybody, and now,
exactly, get some backup.
I mean, I can think of old examples, but I think it would be more forceful if it was like something from the 70s and now it's no longer held. You know, that's a very short amount of time in history. And because of the research in physics, I mean, things are dramatically different than they were 50 years ago.
It's becoming so exponential in the movement. You wonder if it's coming to some kind of crescendo. I mean, do you think it's possible that, I saw a preview. There's a new movie out calling that's going to be called,
what's it called?
Something, oh my gosh, it's based on the fact of if all the technology we know today that we depend on came to a screeching halt.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
That it would, see, it's our infrastructure is based on this technology. Our entire infrastructure would be dramatically changed from the way we do finance. Mm-hmm. It could be so skewed that your bank account no longer recognizes what you have in it.
Yeah, that'd be scary.
Then, or it no longer recognizes you as having this identity or this number that it entitles you to this or doesn't qualify you for something else. The fact that everybody's left to the entire image, that if the technology, meaning the lights, the computer, communication, finance, suppliers, if there's nothing to, if movement can't continue the way it is,
yeah.
We will be in a worldwide crisis, and this could be the framework for World War III, that it doesn't have to be fought with. Who was it that said the war will not be fought with sticks and stones? Some kind of a futuristic. Did Einstein say something about that?
Yeah.
That the future war will not be fought with, and there will be no weaponry. It'll be affecting somebody's electromagnetic burst or that EM or electromagnetic pulse suddenly go off and all of a sudden your cell phone doesn't work, your everything that stores have to close down because their computers are down. Have you ever tried to purchase something somewhere unless you had the cash on hand? You can't purchase because their computers are down.
Somebody
can't help you with a medical thing that you have to have done, or if computers are down today, we can't do your tests. We can't do this MRI.
Yeah.
Our computers are down.
What's interesting to think is that even in that situation, there would be a whole handful of super central questions that wouldn't change. The fundamental questions of existence.
Well, that's a good one.
Be philosophically still intact.
That's right.
I mean, why are we here? Well, you can do as much technological research or scientific research as you want. You can't. It's just fundamentally not a scientific question. So.
I was talking to somebody the other day. Maybe that was an opportunity that. Talking to the place I was going to was closed, so I had to detour and go into another place, and all of a sudden, like Baja Fish or Baja Fresh, a nice place to get it. I like their combo, but now something's different now. They have what's called halal.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that like the Islamic version of kosher?
Yes, that's it. I didn't really understand halal other than the animals aren't put in situations where they're slaughtered and all these poisons go through their body, that the animals are treated gently, and so the meat that they provide for you is better on your body.
Okay.
And it's more spiritual for you to consume, that it's better for you. And all of a sudden, a place that I've known for years, so all of a sudden, adopting the standard of the Muslim because the neighboring restaurants are all doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're having certain buffets for the Feast of Ramadan. And I couldn't even believe it.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't even believe it. But I was having a conversation with somebody. And he's so sure of all of his Muslim beliefs that he's just... feels just as strong about his positions on the Virgin Mary coming from Jerusalem, and Jesus was just really a prophet, but the only true prophet is this Muhammad person, and they feel just as strong about what they believe as what we know to be true. It's really, really challenging Well, we did have a conversation where we were able to meet in the middle. And at least I didn't just throw something out there. I listened and I tried to get a cohesion going, and it ended really well, but it didn't change anything, or at least I thought it did.
Well, and in that situation, I mean, you may not see that person again, but if it was somebody you would have an opportunity to see again, you know, that's a good initial, like, you know, they were even talking to their friend, I ran into this person, they were Christian, but they were a nice person, they were reasonable. I could talk to them, you know, rather than, I hope that person doesn't come in again because they're just going to yell at me. Just real people that can, I mean, if the truth is the truth, it'll play itself out. So I've been trying to give my self permission to stop at step one of Colombo or step two and go back and say, on my own time, I know I'm going to talk to them again. Let me look into this and make sure I got my facts straight. Rather than just say something. I mean, it's the other faults that we can fall into. So, I mean, I hope that's encouraging because, I'm just imagining that situation if it was an ongoing conversation and you only talk to them in bits and pieces, that's kind of perfect because then it gives you time to say, okay, this is another thing I can vote up on.
Next time I have that opportunity to talk with someone like that, perhaps I could, do I have to know what they believe? I did take a class on trying to understand. I really didn't like it because I don't like what they believe. This is what's hard for me. I don't want to learn all about their religion because it doesn't interest me, and I find it, it's creepy to me.
But if we interact in public square, and I mean, say, like, you come to my restaurant often, and even though I'm Muslim, you're like, Chris's restaurant, you know, they always take care of me, he's always polite. I mean, you just come to, like, sort of care about the person in general. Like, that person's an important person. I just watched a video of Francis Chan, who was talking about, you know who Francis Chan is? Okay, he's an evangelical pastor, but, he was just trying to rile up the other pastors that he was speaking to just to remember that engagement where you're thinking about those around you that you interact with and you come to care for, and you start to think about their eternal destiny, and it's compelling you, you know? You know, if that really sinks in, your heart gets moved by that, that's what motivates me when it comes to, you know. And sometimes I don't want to, like, enough about Mormons, but if you're a Mormon and we just had an interaction, like say in the same situation, and you came up with some certain point that I didn't know about, but I'm so compelled that you're a person and this is where you're at, I gotta go there with you. That's kind of the idea, right? I mean, if it's motivated in that direction rather than just knowing the facts, like, rather than just, I gotta figure out this whole religion, just, you know. And that can just come as it comes, you know? I mean, you don't have to, if you interacted with them and you brought up one significant point that you hadn't heard before, you could just go with that one point out of the motivation of, man, this guy is headed in the wrong direction. I mean, maybe I'm the one that God has to put a rock in his shoe. So.
Okay.
Anyways, yes. Okay, well, we have a couple leftovers for the time. So I will be out of town this week, the following week over here.
Okay.
And what I'm going to do actually is, going forward, because I pretty much exhausted the official packets in this book. But what I want to do, which is apropos to what we just said, is I want to throw in a few specific worldviews. So say Islam, right? That's a big thing right now. I want to, probably bring up a few points and do some more interaction model or something else like that, and go through those specific things that we would run into. We've already done some of them, like scientism and pluralism, but there are others, Islam and Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses, and things that are regular occurrences. So, all right.
Yeah. Okay.
Now,
we're supposed to meet to the end of July. Not next week, but there are two more classes after that. people and see if they're coming back, or?
Yeah, I'll talk to Jeff and see. I stopped the recording. But I'll talk to Jeff and see what's going on, what he wants to do.
Yeah, I...
I'll leave that to him. Stop and see what he wants to do. If he says show up, I'll be here and I'll keep there and I'll talk.
Well, I sure appreciate you being here, and I'm glad I came. I enjoyed it, and I'm learning something.
Good.
Something that I can chew on.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's...
Well, yeah, it's a different way of thinking about it, I think, but, I mean, that most people have heard, but it's useful.
I do have a question, though,
yes.
Because I've seen it from this point of view. My question is, and I have to look into this for myself, if when Jesus had the conversation with the high priest Nicodemus about being born again, and he said to him, I am the way, truth, and life. Nobody comes unto the Father but by me. That's a conversation he had with one person. If that were so important, that it's used as an evangelical tool, but if it was that of that supreme importance, why did he not say that on the Sermon on the Mount? Or why didn't he not reinforce that in so many different ways so that beyond question, it's the case? Because I think that's the thing that people have the hardest time with, thinking that, well, God is with me, I'm close, whatever they want to be, whatever they are, whatever they believe, and they think it's good enough.
Yeah.
You know, why to question your relationship with God by one conversation with one person that